This is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, we're talking with Tucson writer and poet Meg Files. Here's her bio. She's the author of novels Meridian 144 and The Third Law of Motion, as well as Home is the Hunter and other stories, The Love Hunter and other poems, and a nonfiction book, Galapagos Triptych, Three Ways of Seeing the Galapagos Islands. A new edition of her instructional book, Writing What You Know, originally from Writer's Digest Books, is out from Allworth Press. She edited Lasting, Poems on Aging. Her stories and poems have appeared in many publications, including Fiction, Writer's Forum, Oxford Magazine, The Tampa Review, and Crazy Horse. Her awards include a Breadloaf Fellowship, two Pushcart Prize nominations, and nominations for the Mountains and Plains Booksellers Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. She was the James Thurber Writer-in-Residence at Ohio State University. She teaches creative writing, directed the Pima Writers Workshop in Tucson for 28 years, and was a faculty member of the Writing at Real Writers Conference for 17, in addition to speaking and teaching at writers' gatherings nationwide. She directs the Tucson Festival of Books, Literary Awards, and Master's Workshop. Welcome, Meg.
It's great to be here, Sheila.
I'm very happy to be talking to you, and I have lots of questions. You write in so many genres, and you have so much experience being a writer in residence and being a teacher and being the head of a wonderful program at the Tucson Book Festival. There's so much to talk about. I've read so many of your books, so it's really a pleasure to be able to talk directly with you about my many questions about writing. So let's start with the fact that you have been teaching and writing for decades, and I'm wondering what lessons you've learned that you consider the most important ones.
Well, I know that many writers find it difficult to have the energy for their own work when they're devoting all their time to their students' writing. And that's certainly true for me as well. At the same time, though, I find inspiration in my students' dedication and even their passion for storytelling. I'm sure that I'm a better writer for all the years of looking at what works and what doesn't work in other people's stories, and also in trying to explain my reasons. So I think that the teaching and the writing go together for me, and I find that my students energize me.
What do you find the most exhilarating about teaching writing?
I just absolutely love nurturing young talent, and, you know, the not-so-young talent, too.
I know, because you've nurtured me, and I would consider myself a not-so-young talent. So I want to thank you personally for that.
And I love seeing those talented writers do the work so that they fulfill their talent. I love seeing their successes. But I also love those moments when a student just suddenly gets it, those breakthroughs.
And I think that they kind of are mirrored when we're doing our own writing, when we suddenly get it, what we're writing about and what's supposed to happen next and what we accomplished. And I think, you know, we talk sometimes about there being a two-way mirror between a reader and a writer in the writing itself. It's like one is looking into the heart and soul of the other. I think that's true in teaching, too. And I think that's the moment you're talking about when suddenly we see each other. Do you think so?
I think that's absolutely correct. I think that's right on.
Well, with that, I love that your book about writing is out again and available. And I was hoping that maybe you could read a little bit from it.
I would love to. And I'm very pleased to have this book out again. It's an updated version. It's got some new exercises and new samples of writing. And it's got some things removed. No references to typewriters anymore. And it's got new information, such as about writing blogs.
We should repeat the title. This book is called Writing What You Know by Meg Files.
Yes, thank you. So this is the opening to the book. When I was 7 years old, I believed I was going to die. Not just someday, as even then I knew we all were. No, I wasn't even going to get to wear my new spring coat and black patent shoes. In the hospital room, which my parents could visit only two specified hours a day, a mean nurse tried to make me swallow a pill the size of a ping-pong ball by holding my mouth shut until a doctor came in and let me spit the nasty pieces into his hand. Another nurse carried a tray to my bedside table, and on the tray was what looked like a small cage covered with a white cloth. I'm going to give you an animal, she said. That's when I got an early lesson in language. Animal and enema may sound alike, but they are altogether different. I've been diagnosed with leukemia. Nobody said, you little girl are going to die now, even before the coloring of the Easter eggs. But I knew. My mother brought me a giant stuffed Easter rabbit too early. Case confirmed. There's a black and white photo of me propped against pillows with that stiff, tall rabbit beside me. I'm wearing a bed jacket. My hair has been brushed and arranged on my shoulders. I look as if I'm trying to be brave. Little girl's last photograph. It was the one that would be in the newspaper, no doubt. My parents bought me a Dale Evans wristwatch so I'd know when visiting hours neared, and maybe to show me I wasn't dying, for it was too expensive to waste on someone who wasn't going to be around to appreciate it. See, time would keep on going for me, right along with the pistol in Dale's hand, ticking off the seconds. There in the high hospital bed, I wrote my first poems. They rhymed badly. They were about wanting to fly and wondering why I couldn't. Then, I didn't die. I left the hospital dramatically by wheelchair. I was home in time to eat the last of the hard-boiled eggs with green and red and blue dye bleeding through the shell to the rubbery egg flesh. I had to wear brown lace-up corrective shoes, not the black patents. But I had not died. I'd been misdiagnosed, really. Yet I understood the syllogism. I'd written poems, and I hadn't died. Therefore, poetry saved my life. Now I think of that flicking hand on the watch counting down the years. For me, writing and mortality are forever bound. Maybe writing is still saving my life.
That's beautiful, Meg. Actually, it brings tears because I can feel the energy of that little girl and the way she's putting life together. And she's so smart. And she's so smart as an adult when she says that poetry is still saving, writing is still saving her life. Thank you. You write in so many genres. And I was wondering how that works for you in your life. How do you know you're going to write a poem? How do you decide what you have to write as a novel? How do you go about your articles, which I know you've done, and personal essays?
For me, the edges among poetry, fiction, and nonfiction are kind of blurry. Whatever I'm writing, it seems that I need to find the voice for that particular poem or story or essay. And I'm working kind of at a sentence level. I'm searching for just the exactly right words, and I'm building sentences. Still, there are, of course, edges and boundaries, and nonfiction is bound to certain factual truth. I think that that's probably why I write more fiction than nonfiction. Basically, I'm a coward. I can tell everybody I made it all up. I know that writing poetry helps my prose. It teaches me lessons that carry right on over, just in terms of, you know, paying attention to language and sound and imagery and the power of suggestion, subtext, what can't be put directly on the page. In my work, I oversee a program that includes freshman composition and developmental writing, and I coach and mentor new instructors. And one of the things I believe is that it's all creative writing. Certain stories, though, still want to be told as novels. Certain stories want to be told as poems. I call them all stories. But sometimes I'm not sure exactly how I decide. It's sort of a gut. Sometimes I start out writing something as a poem, and the limitations of poetry and the confinement of poetry. That sounds like a strange way to talk about poetry, but it does have a different sort of boundary. Sometimes that just isn't sufficient, and I need to tell the fuller story in greater detail in prose. So instinct, I guess, works for me more than anything else. I think, finally, though, I'm really a fiction writer. Sometimes I think we know what we are, by what we read. I read a lot of poetry and creative nonfiction, but really what I'm obsessed with is novels.
Thank you. And it is good to hear that someone as steeped in teaching and writing as you are feels blurry edges, because I think as time's going on here and people are experimenting with forms that seem new but are probably old, fragmented writing, for instance, the prose poetry, those edges are ever increasingly blurred, and yet sometimes we're compelled to write short and sometimes long. Sometimes you can excise something right out of a longer piece, and there it is, a piece of flesh, fiction or nonfiction. Have you ever had that experience?
I have not. I don't know why, but I can't seem to write flash fiction. It just doesn't lend itself to me.
Yeah. Well, I know in your teaching you sometimes use it, and so as models, and then people write longer, perhaps, from it. It's interesting how we use genres even that we might not write in for inspiration. I want to ask you, speaking of fiction, your first novel and your last novel are so different in terms of subgenre. The first novel is a post-apocalyptic story, and the one more recent one is a story that's very grounded in a seemingly contemporary or the past contemporary of a growing up of a young woman. What do you think? Why did you choose to start with such an unreal, hopefully, genre, apocalyptic, and then go to one that seems very, very grounded in life as we know it?
It's interesting that you point out that Meridian 144 is set in the future and the third law of motion is set in the past, in the 60s, and I hadn't really put that together, how the books move around in time so differently. So they're sort of, well, one, I guess we might call the third law of motion kind of an historical novel, and the earlier book a projection into the future. To me, though, they really aren't that different. In both books, I wanted to explore the complexities of human nature, of relationships. Of course, there is a big difference in scope. I wrote Meridian 144 partly because I've always been interested in, obsessed by maybe, Stranded on an Island stories and After the Bomb stories. And so I had the idea of combining the two and writing the story that I wanted to read, the one that I hadn't yet found, featuring a woman alone, or so she thinks, on an island after a nuclear holocaust. Setting the story in the future was a necessary way for me, I think, to look at a bigger picture rather than the zoom-in focus of the third law of motion. So I wanted to explore what seemed to me, at the time I wrote it anyway, to be our self-destructive nature as individuals and, heck, as a species, too.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, Sheila is talking with Tucson writer Meg Files about her writing and her teaching career.
It's haunting to hear you say that. I'm listening to you speak in a climate where it does look like our destructive, self-destructive natures are very apparent globally, nationally. So I think one of the things I've always felt about writing is that literature's predictive in a very frightening way. When what we think is, you know, you said a projection into the future, that is fiction, because you want to examine these forces in human nature. And then what? I mean, the things that writers have imagined seem accurate sometimes, maybe mostly. I heard your sigh. So I think maybe why I want to talk about the third law of motion is because it is a story with an ending that makes me feel good and brings me back to the smaller picture. And you accomplish this novel, which has a protagonist young woman and an antagonist young man. And you accomplish the novel by alternating chapters. Her chapters are in the first person and his chapters are in the third person, which makes for a really good read. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how you decided to do that and what you think the outcomes were for you as a writer.
So as you are pointing out, this is a story about two young people who get themselves in trouble, as we used to say. And I originally was going to write this story just from the girl's point of view, just from Dulcie's perspective. But she sounded, the story features domestic abuse, and she came across as too much a victim when I just presented her side of the story. So I felt that the bad boy, Lonnie, needed his own voice. And I tried writing his chapters from a first-person perspective, but I just couldn't catch the sound of his voice from that I perspective. And so I tried third-person for just a little bit of distance. I think that he perspective, as opposed to the I perspective, reflects Lonnie as a young man who is almost outside of himself, just a little bit outside looking at himself. And so it just felt right somehow. So
you used the word intuition, and now you're saying felt right. And I do think that that's the mystery of writing. Writers try to explain why they do what they do, and very often it is because it felt right or they had an intuition. And I think that's one of the things we love about writing, is that there is mystery. But when you ride the tide of it, it feels right, and so we follow it.
That's right. It's sometimes only from a retrospective perspective that we can explain why that might have been the right decision.
Exactly. So we have to follow what feels right to get it right. You say that for you, the character felt too much like a victim when it was just her story all the way through, and I. What does that mean in writing terms? She was a victim. So what does that mean to you?
I think that oversimplifies the people and the dynamics between them. I think it oversimplifies the situation. Nothing is so simple. Everything is complicated. And to present it only from one side, and it's not exactly sides either. That's not what I mean. She's not right and he's not wrong. She's a victim, yes, but she's also complicit in everything that goes on. She makes choices or fails to make choices. He's a victim, too, in his own way. And I don't want to oversimplify any human relationships or characters.
So I think that's a wonderful thing to say, because I think it is why we read novels, to live in the complications. So one of the things that fascinates me is how you could move a story, a narrative arc, forward and have these two characters addressing the situation and not have things be repetitive for the reader. Like every chapter brings in something new. Every chapter tells us more about this relationship and the events and leads to anticipation about what's going to happen. So did you ever find yourself feeling that that was a battle you were having with yourself as a writer, how to keep this story moving without repeating?
Well, I can see the danger in presenting the story back and forth from the two points of view. And one of the dangers is it could have just become a, you know, she said, he said,
right,
kind of story, with the same events presented and interpreted separately by each character. And there are stories that do that, and sometimes they're kind of interesting. But I think that would really limit this story. There are little bits of repetition here and there, necessarily, but mostly the story just goes forward, just from shifting perspectives. I like to think that the reader gets to know the characters well enough to be able to imagine how each one would be thinking and feeling in reaction to the other one and to those particular events.
So that's
so
key.
I hope it works. Yeah,
well, it does, and that's key, I think. It explains for me how you approached it as a writer, that their reactions to one another, understanding that, is key to how the story unfolds and doesn't repeat itself as they move along. I think it's quite an achievement to tell the story from two points of view, and we always feel we're in the story. So thank you for that explanation. And now I want to bring up a phrase that I've heard you use quite a bit since I've been around you while you're teaching. And you will tell your students not to be afraid of what's weird. In fact, you'll say, keep it weird. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what that means to you as a teaching tool.
As we speak, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says, Scuba, it's all about the weird stuff. I am a scuba diver, and I love the strangeness of being underwater. But when I talk to my students about writing weird or strange, I'm encouraging them, I think, to write the stories that only they can write in the ways that only they can write them. So I think that means not trying to figure out the formula or the conventional way or the correct way to tell a story, to write, or to imitate anybody, but to take the risks that they need to take with their material and with their style, too, with their voices. I might say a little bit more about what I mean by strange in terms of content, in terms of the telling, the manner of telling, the angle of the narration, letting in the insider stuff that each writer knows about in terms of close observation, in terms of language, and really the key, I think, is voice. All of those things lead to originality. I might quote G.K. Chesterton, who said, "The function of the imagination is not to make strange things settled, so much as to make settled things strange."
That's wonderful.
So the weird approach makes us see things, startles us into seeing things in new ways. I wanted to read just a little bit more here, not from my work, but from something that Carolyn Kaiser, poet, wrote in her foreword to a book called On Poetry and Craft by Theodore Rethke. She had been Rethke's student. She said, "The most important thing Rethke ever said to me was after class when another student was very critical of some eccentric thing I had done, and Ted admonished him, 'You want to be very careful when you criticize something like that because it may be the hallmark of an emerging style.' He knew that our eccentricities are part of our true voice." Mm. And that's the weird stuff.
Yes, and I will always remember your scuba T-shirt. And say it again, what it says. It says scuba.
Scuba. It's all about the weird stuff.
All right. I'm going to walk out of the studio today looking at the world that way. Thank you. Meg, do you have anything about this Keep It Strange, Keep It Weird in your book on Write What You Know?
I do, and it connects with the scuba weird stuff.
All right.
This is the opening of Chapter 2 called Facing Down the Monsters, Quieting the Fears That Hold Back Stories. "I leaped headlong into the sea," wrote Keats on the experience of writing his long poem, Endymion, "and thereby have become better acquainted with the soundings, the quicksands, and the rocks, than if I had stayed upon the green shore and piped a silly pipe and took tea and comfortable advice. For writers, that green shore is a pretty place, a sweet place to hang out. We know its gentle flora and fauna, its bobwhites and dragonflies, its buttercups and soft grass. It is a safe place. The worst that can happen there is an ant or two in the potato salad. Those who rest on the shore may write some lovely poems, some clever tales, some suitable for the grandchildren recollections. However, it is only by jumping into the deep that we may, sometimes, create fresh, surprising, or profound writing. We may pass seaweed strangely blossoming underwater on our way down. We may encounter an ill-tempered anaconda powerful enough to crush a deer. We may discover odd creations such as the dugong with its front limbs like arms and at the end, not legs, but a tail. We will find strange beauty, danger, and bizarre connections. In the depths, we may find squid making ink clouds around themselves or white eyeless fish, or some memories want to hide and some images want to be blind. It is only by jumping into the murky and the unknown that we stand a chance of discovering our truths."
Ah, thank you. That's very encouraging and very beautiful, and especially knowing that you're a scuba diver and have taken those images that you see to heart. So before we close, Meg, can you quickly tell us what your teaching plans, your writing projects are right now and in the near future?
I'm going to be teaching a couple of sections of a novel writing class that I love doing. And right now I'm spending some time trying to figure out which novels I want to teach in this coming semester. I do different novels every semester. I'm kind of reconnecting with my own post-apocalyptic story and thinking about choosing three more recent apocalyptic stories for the theme for this semester. I'm also going to teach a poetry writing class. Mm-hmm. I'm continuing to work on a novel I've been working on for some time about growing up in the American West, so I'm hoping I'll have some more time to get back to that.
That sounds excellent, and I know that you'll continue to be inspired by your students and they from you. Meg, can you give us information on how to find more out about you online?
I have an Amazon page, and so you can find me there. And my website, I hope, will be revived soon. It's megfiles.com.
All right, and then we look for you on Amazon by Meg Files author page, I think is the way you search for it. I want to thank you so, so very much for this conversation. It's been exhilarating for me, and I look forward to talking with you again in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love talking with you about writing.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.